Hello, and welcome to the Green Team of the Legendarium, the weird little spin-off podcast where patrons of the Legendarium get together to talk about the books and topics that the main crew hasn't gotten around to yet. I'm Seeker, and today I have with me Jingles 90.
Hello.
And today we are discussing the second book in the Paxinarian trilogy. Jingles, what's it called?
Divided Allegiance.
There we go. Divided Allegiance. I wrote down everything but the title of the book we're doing. All right. So, general impression.
Anyone who listened to our last episode, I believe I used the word uplifting to describe it, which maybe was an exaggeration at that point, but we have gone completely the other way. Not to say that means it's a bad book. I actually quite enjoyed it. But yeah, the end of this one just gets so dark.
I think you described it well when you referred to it as The Empire Strikes Back, except without the victory at the end.
Yeah.
It like ends at the darkest spot of the Battle of Hoth.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, yeah, there's just no getting around that. This book leaves Paxinarian in a terrible place, which, yeah, we can get into more during spoilers.
We won't do spoilers yet, but...
Yeah, but it's just, it's a middle book in all the right ways, I think, in my opinion, because it leaves you intrigued by what is coming up in the final book, and then it also... Yeah, it also just leaves you emotionally tied, which I really like.
And I think it does a lot for preparing and training her for what she will face in the next book. You know, and I don't just mean weapons and horseback riding. There are certain aspects of her personality that we mentioned in the last one where she's like, yes, he's a good person, he's a good fighter, and I like him. Like, everyone who's good in her mind is a good fighter. And many of the things that she goes through here, I think, will help her realize that A, good fighter doesn't mean good person, and B, good person doesn't mean good fighter.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like pretty much reiterating what you're saying, but yeah, there's a huge tunnel vision to Pax's morality that is brought into question here. And I think that Elizabeth Moon does a really good job of making us understand that Pax's scope of understanding is far too small to actually get to the point where she can be a paladin so far. Yeah. But
yeah, that is what I think a lot of this book is expanding her understanding of the world, her understanding of people, her understanding of suffering, you know.
Yeah. It kind of plays in a lot of fun ways with the Chosen One trope in that way, because we're actually seeing, you know, the main character, who I think we can very safely assume is going to come out on top in the end and is going to do something amazing. I mean, this trilogy is called The Deed of Paxinarian, and we know that at some point we have to see something,
right,
that is worthy of that title.
Well, we also know in the beginning, in the prologue of the first book, she is recognized as a full-fledged paladin.
Yes. Yeah.
So we know that's going to happen. We just don't know how.
How. And I think it's really fun that we're taking the time to get her to that point versus just like, oh, she's the farm girl from an out-of-the-way place who's learning about all this crazy lore that's happening. And oh, by the way, she's also like the best person ever, who is immediately that good and is immediately doing all the great things. We don't really see that out of her. There are some instances where that character obviously has to come out because it's, you know, it's a characteristic that's inherent in her. It exists within her already, but it's not every single thing she does is amazing.
Right. I completely agree. And I think in some ways, like The Hobbit, this book spends, as you mentioned, it plays with the hero's trope. And I was thinking, my very first note is hero's journey.
Yep.
And, you know, this, the first book, she receives the call. She meets her wise mentors. In this book, she starts her training. And it ends with the descent into hell. And mm-hmm. in The Hobbit, for example, the descent into hell is very figurative and very short. You could, I guess, in The Lord of the Rings, you could call the second half of The Two Towers, the trek through Mordor and Shelob's lair, the descent into hell. And especially when, you know, Sam has to carry Frodo. And I, you know, but even there, all of the hell is external, whereas with Pax, it's internal.
No, almost exclusively.
It's a very different way of approaching, you know, all that. And before we start talking spoilers, which we're already halfway doing, why don't you read us the thingy, the blurb.
Synopsis there?
Synopsis, sounds thank good. You. All I'm going right. to work on my Greek or Latin or whatever that word's from.
So, divided allegiance. Things have not been going well for Pax since the fall of Siviana. Duke Valan's company is still morally upright and humane, but that cannot be said for the people they have allied with. When a few of the commanders, including Valan, notice Pax's discomfort with their allies, Valan instructs Pax to take leave, indefinitely if need be, from the company. So begins Pax's journey back north. Hold tight with us as we try to get through everything that happens in the next 500 pages. Along the way, she'll do some dungeon crawling, free an elven spirit from the grips of evil, make and lose new friends, battle bandits with ties to a spider goddess, spend some time in a grange, travel to a paladin school, get recruited as a paladin, go on a journey to find the stronghold of the paladin god's companion, become a POW that has to fight for her life to survive, get rescued and judged for that survival, get magical surgery, get immense trauma from said surgery, and then get left to heal on her own. We really get hit by the Empire Strikes Back bug here, ending the book on a dark note where Pax's fate is left uncertain, but all seems to be lost.
Yep. And it really does the last paragraph is just downright depressing.
I mean, they don't even tell you where she is. It's just gone.
We have no idea. She's just, you know, and it's just letters, communiques going, well, we last heard of her here.
Yeah. And, you know, the Grand Marshal clearly, you know, wants to try to help Pax as much as she can, but there's so much apathy to the other people trying to like pay attention to this. Like some of them are trying harder than others, but
yeah. Well, she's also suffering from, I don't know if it's the basic human stereotype or the basic good people trope of if you don't live up to our expectations of you as a good person, then we have serious doubts about how good you actually are.
Right. And I think a lot of it, you know, is internal doubts for herself as well. Like she clearly wants to avoid the Granges at some point.
Well, from the very beginning, she wants to avoid them. And then when she gets there and just, she can't handle the look of, you know, which it actually got me wondering if this is sometimes what, you know, soldiers with severe PTSD feel like going to events with other soldiers or whatever. It's like, will they think I'm weak? Do they think I'm, you know, whatever? And then, of course, if someone who's active duty who hasn't had the trauma is like, oh, man, you did all this cool stuff and, you know, freaks the guy out because, you know, he can't handle that anymore. And then they're like, wait, you were a hero. You're a coward.
Yeah, that's exactly what came to mind for me, too. I was wondering how much of this has to do with Elizabeth Moon's own experiences with people who have PTSD after war or just serving in general.
Yeah, or just read about it, you know. I mean, one of my favorite authors, military authors, for how the military works, what it's like being in service, has never been in the military.
Okay, so that's actually something interesting about Elizabeth Moon, is she actually did serve in the Marine Corps, And she also worked as an EMT for a base. So,
she saw a lot of hurt.
Yeah, she's seen a lot of hurt. And I don't think it's too surprising that she has a pretty strong understanding of that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, so it's a really rough ending. But like I said, it's also the one thing that, you know, it's driving me to want to read the other one almost immediately.
Read the next one.
Yeah. Because
speaking of starting at the beginning, shall we?
Yeah, we should.
Okay. So, you know, at the end of the last book was kind of confusing because it ended with her going and seeing her family. So the start of this book, that ain't happening. She sets out because, you know, she just can't stand all the, what you might call peacekeeping that's going on, you know, not from her company, but they have to keep the crowds in order while their allies go around massacring their rivals and, you know, basically pulling a purge of the opposition royal families and dukes and whatever.
Yeah. Public executions and torture. Just stuff that they are not, that Phalanx company is not.
Yeah, well, okay, anyone who's read about a political revolution would go, oh yeah, that's normal.
Sure.
Those who haven't, think of the Red Wedding. A little Game of Thrones reference there. Yeah. But yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to bookend this. You know, starting with all of the stuff that she absolutely detests and then getting caught up in it on her own and then kind of shooting out the other end just completely torn and miserable. One kind of has to wonder if, you know, staying with Phalanx company might have been better for her. It almost certainly would have been.
It would have been less traumatizing, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, she'd have never been captured by, excuse my wrong world reference, by the drow.
Yeah. Oh, you're close. No, you're not off.
I am not going to remember what she called them here.
Yeah. I was trying to remember, when did this come out compared to when the drow were introduced? Well,
Tolkien mentions dark elves in the Silmarillion.
Sure. So, but
I mean, that's established fantasy lore, but.
Do the dark elves in, I guess they do, because they have Shelob and other. I'm trying to think, like, specifically the worshipping of dark gods that are designed like spiders.
My memory of the Silmarillion, I guess we can message Craig, but my memory of the Silmarillion is that the dark elf just lives in like a deep, dark part of the forest, and kind of really weird incest stuff happens with his family, and he like kidnaps and marries his daughter, and I don't know what. It's just, you know, he just kind of goes crazy, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's been several years since I read the Silmarillion, and it's not a novel. You know. No, as Craig has said, this is a history book.
Yeah, and it's easy to forget bits of history when they're only half a sentence or half a paragraph.
Yeah, or when half of it is told in rhyme.
Yeah.
You know, which Tolkien loved to do. But yeah, so, no, they're I mean, I refer to them as drow, but there's no mention of them looking any different from the above world elves, except that they worship the dark gods, and their features, where the others are lovely, these are horrible and terrible.
Yeah. You know, and some of these have taken on like some of the aspects of spiders, right? They have like their,
I don't know. I know they use the webs and stuff, but I don't know if anybody's actually turning. Like, I don't think we have any demi spiders. We just have the servant of the spider goddess. So she leaves the company and she heads north, and teams up with that, I don't know, part elf, I guess, you know, who says he's an elf and says he's a half elf, and everybody else is like, yeah, no. But the one part of that whole thing that really bugged me is they set up camping for the night, and he tells her she has this magic ring that can control animals, and a snow cat shows up. And this snow cat is a magical creature that doesn't just eat you, but devours your soul and kind of feeds on your soul in the cosmic realm. And the elf tells her to hold it still with the ring, and then he kills it. And she enters this massive moral crisis over doing this. And the impression I get is that it wouldn't have bothered her if she'd have thrown a net over it, or if they had had some kind of snare and it had gotten caught in it, and then, you know, stab it. But because she held it with the ring, it's like, it's a defenseless creature and you murdered it while it was defenseless. This whole, while it was defenseless, is a common theme you see over and over again with quote-unquote honorable people. And I've never understood it.
So I would kind of actually bring this back to the end of the book, in that they have penetrated the cat's mind. And they have manipulated her to the point where the cat has no option on what it's doing. And that very much matches with what Pax is doing when she's a POW, right? I think there's some incredible... Elizabeth Moon does a lot with foils in this, like Maesenian, the cat, the girl from Brewer's Bridge that really wants to leave and things. And I think what all of them have to do is they're taking aspects of Pax's life, her fears, her, you know, her concerns, her things that she doesn't have a lot of knowledge in, and they're amplifying those things so that she can explore them.
Okay.
So
you think that part of it?
So I think
she's afraid of someone doing that to her, and that's why it terrifies her so much.
That's why it terrifies her so much. And she ends up, I mean, that's what draws her into hell, right?
That's true. That is exactly what happens.
Is she gets manipulated. Yeah. And I don't think that mirroring is, I don't think that mirroring is coincidental.
Yeah. As a storyline, as a growth thing, that actually makes a lot of sense.
I was kind of bothered by that too, up until the end of the book, where I was just, why does she keep harping on this cat thing? Like, it's not a great scenario. I get why she has some problems with it, but it's the one thing.
Yeah, she's waking up with nightmares because she held the animal that was trying to kill her while somebody else killed it.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's the one thing that I think she's ever killed a person where it's not easily justified for her. It's not in a battle. It's not for protection. It's just kind of malicious.
Yeah. Well, Pax is definitely, at least up until this point, she's definitely the kind of person who, if a vicious enemy or even someone who was crazy was trying to kill her and for whatever reason somehow got knocked out during the fight, she would not finish it. She'd be like, no, he's defenseless now, so we just leave him. It doesn't matter that 5 minutes later he wakes up and tries to stab her. It's like, oh, now I can kill him because he's attacking. You know. And that is her type of personality.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if Moon would see it this way, but Pax in some ways to me is just a very flat character. I mean, she is.
Oh, in the first book, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. She has very, like we said, she's basically lawful good.
Yeah. And like the farthest end of it, she's not like Dungeons and Dragons Honor Amongst Thieves level where she's going to walk over a rock instead of around it, you know, but she is.
She has her own code and her very strict sense of very narrow rules of what defines good and honor. Yeah. And it's all based off of minstrel's tales that she heard as a kid.
Yeah. And because her knowledge base is so narrow, it works incredibly well when she is in a focused area. but not when it becomes a broader thing. I mean, another continuing that mirroring process, you know, at the end of the book, the paladins, the marshals, they all judge her for choosing to fight as a POW instead of just dying.
And she's like, right? But I fought. Which is a weird thing, because that's what GERD wants me to do, is fight.
Yeah. And that's what she was thought was bad about the cat whole time, is it didn't have the opportunity to fight back.
Yeah, we deprived it of its chance.
She's seeing that there's a different.
And then they're telling him, well, actually, your fighting back was what allowed the evil in.
It's an interesting.
Those are good points. Yeah, I couldn't get past my frustration with, oh, this again.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think your frustration's totally unfounded. Like, Maesenian is not a trustworthy character. We fully find that out. And
she is so naive.
Yeah. And it might be that he is absolutely right. This is the way to handle the cat. But he is so negligent in everything else. It's hard to believe that, especially after he dies and you hear like, oh yeah, he wasn't a very good elf, because he's not really an elf.
He's not even a half elf. He's like, you know, his great great grandmother or something was an elf. And it's like, okay.
No, you know, I think four grandmothers down, but
yeah, he's quite the character, and I think it's very karmic that it's his own careless arrogance that gets him killed. You know, nothing Pax does. It's like he initiates the confrontation that kills him.
Yeah, that's what. If you find four orcs in a cave, do you really think you're only going to find four orcs in a cave? Let's think about this for a second.
It's like, if you have the option to hide while they're walking by, I recommend hiding.
Yeah,
you know, and he wasn't even driven by like bloodlust. It was just sheer careless arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
And then she feels guilty because he died and she failed in protecting him.
Yeah, which I don't understand why the Elven Tag saved her at that moment.
Well, I think the Elven Tag needed her to save him.
Right, but I don't understand like when she actually did that, because it clearly saved her from the Orc Horde.
It did.
But I don't understand the connection of where.
Well, I think. Okay, so while she's fighting, she gets driven back towards the Elven Tag, and her hand grasps something. And I think that contact is what freed. Okay. The Elfin Tag, or whatever it was. And so now he owes her, because she just rescued him from God knows how long he's been trapped by that whatever it was. And so that's the way I saw it, is her touching him freed him, and then he now owed her, so he got her out of there, rescued her, and gave her all the armor and scrolls and stuff as a kind of payment for. You know, because I mean, when you hear the rest of the people talk about him being freed, it's a big deal, you know, and not just for the Elfin Tag. It's a big deal for the elves and for the good of the realm. So that's how I interpreted that.
I do love the little world building bit there, where it's like everything that it gives her is so nonchalantly given, because it just. I don't have any use for any of this stuff, but it turns out to be like super important tomes for humans,
right.
The paladins, and you know, magical armor. Their mithril.
Yeah, she basically armor. Gets a mithril, a mithril chainmail.
Yeah.
Extremely light and extremely strong.
Yeah, that's what I did. Going back to kind of how the hero's journey plays out amongst just these two books so far, I do love the first book being pretty much a solid military fantasy book where almost no magic happens. No. It's very limited until the very end.
And even then it's almost completely unrelated to Pax.
Yeah. And then in this one we've just straight up gone into standard like D&D Forgotten Realms Dragonlance fantasy where she's actually running around going into dungeons, coming out of dungeons with a bunch of armor.
Selling the armor.
Changing out that armor randomly. Going back into another dungeon.
Like, yep.
Selling the armor. Yeah. How'd you feel about the whole Brewer's Bridge piece?
Yeah, I'd say a good third of the book is Brewer's Bridge. I thought it was very well paced, as far as I can judge such things. Get my attention. It began a lot of things that could go places, like the Quaknam, or whatever he's called, the basically the druid.
The Quaknam.
You know, we don't know much about him at all, except that he cares for animals and has some really powerful magic. And then you've got the Grange, and you get to see kind of like what a border garrison of these soldiers for right and good, what life with them is like. You get the whole side character with the girl who wants Pax to take her on as her apprentice. You know, all of that could go somewhere, could not. They could just be mirrors for Pax, or they could be storylines that'll play out later. It's hard to say.
Yeah. That's kind of the, I wish I remembered the girl's name, Sinya or something like that. If this plays out like any fantasy I've ever read, is like, oh, she's going to find Archaea and become a worshiper of darkness, right?
She's going to become an archvillain. Yeah.
Yeah.
that's classic Hostile Brothers, you know. The two people meet, they're kind of friends, or they are friends, but they part ways, and next time they meet, they're arch enemies.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting listening to her, you know, bestow wisdom to hold off, but at the same time, not telling her not to go pursue, pursue it in the right way, which to her, the right way is the way she did it. You know, like the wisdom is kind of, the wisdom's kind of flat.
But it's also sound wisdom in that, you know, if you go off randomly, your experiences and your training will be random. If you want to get a good solid foundation, you know, if you want to become an engineer, you go to engineering school. Yes, you can do it with a book. If you want to go that route, you know, results may vary.
Yeah, that's true. I find it's a nice, it's a nice level that they put her wisdom at, because it is, she's not telling you not to do something. She's just telling you to think about how you're choosing to do it. Especially since the girl is very much a hothead.
Mm-hmm.
She very much feels like she has something to prove, and she feels everyone's holding her back, which I would say is not the way Pax felt. She just desperately did not want to get married and do something else. She wanted to be a hero.
Yeah, you really don't get the impression in the first book that she's trying to prove anything. She doesn't really have a chip on her shoulder. She just is trying to be the best soldier she knows how.
Yeah, like she knows that's what she wants to do. Like, you never hear anything poor about her parents. The only thing she has against her parents is that her dad, you know. Yeah,
her dad tried to force her to marry her. And even that, she's not really all that resentful. She's just like, well, you know, he didn't have a lot of family, and he wanted to, you know, marry me off, because that's what we do in that village.
Yeah, I can't wait for her to go back to that guildsman and actually like see how much she's made, because right now she has nothing. Like, that's got to be sitting, right?
Yeah, well, does she still have it? Because when she joined the Grange, or the main school, I think they had her send it all to her family.
I thought they had her send everything that she had on her to her family. I didn't think there was.
No, she had to send all the money she had on account too. She had to, she had to pay.
Okay.
When they realized how much money they had, they asked her to pay for her training, and strongly implied that, you know, she's supposed to send all of her wealth to her family, which is, this might be personal experience getting in the thing here, but it's one thing I absolutely detest about religious orders in general is the vow of poverty, because it's a trap.
Okay.
Yes, when you're there, you have all your needs met, if it's a good one, but then how the hell do you leave? You're flat broke. You got nothing because you gave it away. As shown
is when she left, right?
Either. Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. But I mean, but this happens in real life. You've got people who take holy orders or become monks or whatever. And I don't know. I mean, obviously rules may vary, but traditionally speaking, you give all the money to the church, or maybe you give it to a relative before you join the church. You know, you renounce your titles, you take a vow of poverty, then you go join the monastery or whatever. And unless you've got really nice family, you're SOL if you decide this isn't your life.
Yeah. That's true. You've had no foundation for anything.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it'd be much better if she could have just, you know, left it with the money lenders, and, you know, it's like, well, it's there if I need it later.
Right.
You know, but that, again, if you're joining a holy order, like they say, we want you to be completely dedicated.
Right.
So it's, I understand the demanding of complete dedication. It's basically the arch-shaped Tarangrial.
Right.
You know, you have to prove that you want it more than anything else in the world. But at the same time, just because you want it more than anything else in the world right now doesn't mean that will always be the case in real life. You know, an Aes Sedai can't exactly renounce the one power, but...
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. The whole paladin way of living is definitely not the way I would ever exist in this world.
Like, no.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but only Sith deal in absolutes, right? We're looking
at some. Let's just bring the entire greater. Yeah.
Let's just alienate whoever we can, but we'll put a little bit of everything so you can all come back in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, you know, when you bring it back to the paladins, I think Fallon had the right of it during the during her trial at the end, and before she got the brain surgery or whatever it was that they did to her. Because it's this whole scenario is like, oh, well, you were a POW, and we feel sorry for you, but you didn't go about being a POW the right way. And that's made right. you morally susceptible.
And well, then, I mean, I don't blame them for that, because that is literally what happened. It's like she got a tumor and they had to remove the tumor, you know?
Yeah. According to them, that's literally what happened. But as we have established, Pax is kind of just going with whatever people are telling her is okay. Cause she has,
really, if we assume no Pax is the narrator. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It all depends on how reliable these other, because we do go from the perspective of some of these other people, mm-hmm. and they're saying, you know, like when the head of the order is talking with the Duke, and he's like, it's risky, but we don't have any choice. We know it's there. We have to get it out, and it could destroy her. But if we don't, she will become a tool of evil. She's basically going to be, you know, she's basically got a gold symbiote growing inside her, and they got to get it out.
Right. They got to fry that thing. But it's frustrating, you know, get to the point where, you know, she's done everything that she possibly can to try to stand by this order. Mm-hmm. The one time where she felt that she needed to survive, she tried.
And from her perspective, she feels betrayed.
Yeah.
You know, although, you know, in a sense, I wonder if this is actually what it's like for soldiers in like the earlier stages of trauma or PTSD, because like you see with Kaladin, excuse me for any possible Stormlight spoilers here, but there's a stage where he reaches a point where he has to get pulled out of the field.
Yeah.
You know, and I wonder if in real life, you know, the sergeants, the officers start noticing the signs and go, dude, we got to yank you or you're going to kill somebody. And he feels betrayed. He's like, I did all this for you. I suffered all this for you. And now you're taking away the one thing I'm good at. You know, so I don't know. Having never been there, having never studied this, I don't know.
This is all armchair, right? I have no idea. Just from the perspective of like
We're experts of reading the stories people have written about people who do this kind of stuff. I mean, every example is either sci-fi or fantasy novel here.
Yeah, I've got maybe some Tom Clancy under my belt, but Tom Clancy never really played with the PTSD aspect of things.
No, he, not at all.
Maybe with John Clark. But so, yeah, it's. Yeah, I think I don't know how you can read the end of this book, though, and not just be totally frustrated for Pax. Like, I really
absolutely
do feel for her in a way that, and, you know, looking back on it and trying to have some objectivity, like, she makes the decision to leave on her own. They don't force her to leave.
They ask her to stay, even if all she can do is wash dishes, basically. And she's like, I couldn't do that here. It'd be too embarrassing.
Yeah.
And, so,
yeah, she refuses the hospitality of every group that is open to her.
Yeah, even, you know, I mean, she seems to do most well with the old ladies at the end, but realizes, you know, she's no good at learning how to spin yarn or whatever it is they do to make money. And so she leaves rather than, you know, even though she could use the money she has to help buy food for the winter, she just decides to walk out on them, you know. And I don't know if that's some form of, you know, abandonment trauma where she's worried that they'll not like her if they get to see how, you know, because she doesn't like herself right now.
Yeah.
So maybe she thinks, well, if they realize I'm really a coward, then they won't like me because she hates herself for being a coward. Yeah. Moon did some really deep character stuff in this, and the only, you know, the salvation of this book is, where's part three?
Right, yeah.
We know she comes out the other side. And it's like, the question is, how does she recover from this?
Yeah. And,
you know? And I'm hoping, I don't think it will, but I'm hoping it's not a deus ex machina where, you know, Gerd just shows up, puts a hand on her head, and goes, you are healed.
Oh, I really hope it's not that. I'd be so upset. I believe in Elizabeth Moon at this point that that's not the way we're going to take this.
No, but, I mean, especially since she's made such a point of showing the gods do not take, you know, direct action.
They take if they do anything, it's very minor. It never plays in any huge way. Like, we do still have, well, was that even Gerd's interaction, or was that just when she healed the shoulder wound? Was it, that just... Well,
it was most likely Gerd working through her.
Yeah, because, channeling her healing powers.
Everybody who's heard about it except her believes it was Gerd.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to believe it. I honestly don't know why she's so resistant to the idea that a god could have answered her prayer.
The paladins are interesting because they are all so dang good, it seems like. There's, you know, they falter a little bit.
The paladins themselves, yes, but we definitely met one senior member of the order that was definitely not good.
No, well, was she not good?
The lady who cares for her when she's recovering.
Yeah, yeah. You know. Was she not good, though, or was she just upset in that one moment?
I think she's envious of Pax and views her as having gotten special treatment. But yeah, so we got a question here, which we've kind of more or less covered. But first half of the book has a lot of similarities to what people call progression fantasy. For the record, I have no idea what that means.
Okay.
I'll try to explain
it as best I can.
How do you think the style of the first half would hit people today?
Okay. Well, I think... So let me just make sure I'm not doing anything totally out of place here. Progression fantasy is supposed to be, you know, a genre that's dependent on the character starting at a base and progressively getting better and better in their skills to the point where they're almost unstoppable.
Okay, so D&D style fantasy.
Yeah, or like I think the most common...
Leveling up.
Yeah, the most common comparison I usually hear is like Dragon Ball Z. Like if you have Goku... Yeah, Goku always gets better, right? He always moves higher up.
Never watched it, never played, but I'm aware of it.
Okay. So, I hope
my younger brothers watched it.
Yeah. I'm sure I've read something that's considered progression fantasy, but the term itself seems so general to me. I don't know. I mean, it's a subgenre like any other.
I've played enough. I'm blanking on the style of game, but it's the game like Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, know, like an action RPG.
And actual RPG, you know, where you collect the stuff and your characters level up as you go until by the end you can kill the dragon, you know.
And I think, you know, Pax in her way is doing that. Like, not to the extreme levels that you see in those games, but so far. But she is like going into dungeons, getting better equipment, doing the thing, doing the D&D thing, and getting stronger as she goes.
I've heard, like, there was a critique of Jessica Jones, and they were talking about how Jessica Jones did it really well because Jessica never levels up. She just faces a different challenge in each season. And so, unlike Buffy or unlike Dragon Ball Z, she doesn't get more powerful with each conquest. She faces different opponents, which require a different tactics and different set of skills to overcome.
Yeah, I think you nailed it on the head. Like, there's a little bit more going on here than just getting stronger.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Paxinarian's improvements are always more than just her fighting capabilities.
Well, especially in this book.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially the second half of this book. The last third or whatever it is. In order to come out of this, there is going to have to be a massive amount of personal growth and self-examination and forgiving herself.
Yeah.
You know. Second half of that same was final third, too much? ? Does your opinion differ given the author's gender? I guess that's referring to the scene in the barn. Is it okay for women authors to write stories about attempted rape on women? I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
I have thoughts on this, but go ahead. It sounds like you do too.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think that the gender plays too much of a role here.
Of the author,
I think she's more thoughtful in general than most authors, so this ends up being, how do I say this without it sounding like total creep?
I'm just going to step in this, and if people yell at me, they can, I don't know, find me on Discord or something. But we like to pretend these days that sexual assault is both a culture and it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
At the same time. And I don't think that contradiction is healthy because, this is a pre-industrial culture where, for the most part, Mike equals right. You literally settle arguments with your fists. There are bad people, and some of those bad people, I mean, it's the assault is committed by two thieves, and bad people do bad things, and assaulting weaker people is one of the things bad people do.
Yeah.
And I don't think we can tiptoe around that.
Okay. I think I have what I want to say. Just, I generally have a hard time with depictions of rape in anything. I think any person does. So in the last episode, when we were discussing the attempted rape, I made, I think, a pretty decent argument for why that particular scene needed to exist in the book.
Uh-huh.
I don't have an easy way of saying why that needs to be here in this one.
No, I think we'll find out in the next book.
Okay. I when I was reading this scene, I was like, oh, we almost made it through the whole dang thing without this.
Although it could have been like what I said about Dragon Riders, it could have been Elizabeth Moon may have experienced this and she's like, sorry, this is just part of life, and it would not be fair to the women who suffer to ignore it.
No, and I don't think, yeah, I would agree with you. Like I said, I think there's a lot more thought going into this than just, oh, it's a rape scene for shock.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, it's just, it comes in.
Even in the story, it drives her out, it drives her into the country, it shows how people are judging her and treating her just because of the way she looks, because of the scars on her face.
Yeah, and she has no proper way of handling her situation anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of, it's just a little, maybe a little extra jarring for me, because this is a character who pretty fundamentally is asexual, just really has no desire for any sort of sexual interaction whatsoever.
Yeah, it's like someone trying to rape Sheldon.
Yeah, like, and this is just, yeah, it's just uncomfortable. And then this is added on top of what is already like a really sad and frustrating scenario for her. So it's just like a really, really odorous, terrible cherry on top of an awful sundae.
Oh, I agree. It's definitely, everything. I mean, it's basically the last thing that happens before the epilogue. If you consider everything after this in the epilogue, which I kind of do, because it's mostly just letters.
Yeah, there's no actual character development. It's just kind of a, here's a final bit on what's happening with her.
Here's letters writing each other about what we know about her and where she's been and what she's doing. But the last time we see anything from her perspective is her running out into the snow half-dressed.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, yeah, that is a hell of a place to leave a book.
But yeah, so I guess to answer Era's question really short, I think it may have edged into too much, but not all the way into too much.
For those who are concerned, who are listening, who haven't read it, there are no graphic descriptions of anything.
No.
There are struggles. There's indications of someone hitting somebody. But there are no, it does not get graphic. It does not get, what's the word? Gratuitous. There are no gratuitous descriptions.
Yeah, and I think that's what saves it, is that it's not overly explicit in what's happening. Trying not to be like the book and ending on a sad note.
Yeah. Well, when the book has, I mean, we began on this note, kind of, and we're ending on this note.
Just like the book.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it is just one of those books where it's a middle book, and they have packed a ton of traumatic character growth. This is the descent into hell. We are currently stuck in Pinocchio's whale stomach, or whatever it's called. Monstro. There we go.
Monstro, yeah.
We're currently stuck in Monstro's stomach trying to find food, and there isn't any. You know, and that's where this book ends. So. But definitely, you know, like you said, well written, nothing seems gratuitous, definitely a lot of build up for a very good expected payoff, hopefully.
Hopefully. We still don't know what happens to
No, and I still, I have it, I looked up my Goodreads because I did not remember this book even after I listened to it. Yes, I had rated it and reviewed it. Can't remember a thing. And I really liked it. I remember recommending it to my mom, and she enjoyed the trilogy. And she does not go for dark at all.
Okay.
As she puts it, the only vampire movie she's ever enjoyed is Blade.
Great vampire movie. I can't
blame
her.
The first one.
Yeah.
You know? And, well, it's because good conquers evil, you know. So that is a hopeful note. And we know she becomes a paladin, so we know, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. And maybe that's why Moon did this, that intro, because she knew she was going to take us on a really dark journey, and she wanted to give people hope that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. And I Yeah, to become a true paladin, you have to truly see the bottom of the barrel and find your way mm-hmm. through the darkness and explode
out. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is... I mean, it's kind of a trope, but it's also a realism that in order to help people, you have to understand suffering. You know?
Yeah. That's so, a very empathetic take.
On a scale of 10... where would you rate this book?
Ooh, I think I'd give it an 8.5 or 9. I, like, really loved this book. It was okay. quite
Let's
good for
go
me.
For 9. I would do an 8. So, an average of 8.5 for us.
Yeah.
Oh, 8.5, that would be, on a scale of 5, that would be a 4.25.
Yep.
On Goodreads, it has 306 ratings with a 4.17.
Okay.
So we're floating around, us, but very good for Goodreads.
Yeah.
On Amazon, it's got 509 reviews and a solid 4.5.
Okay. So we're sitting somewhere in that. We're sitting we're right in the group.
There with 4.5. Yeah. We're on the Amazon end, yeah. Which I've heard that Goodreads tends to be a lot more critical. Which kind of makes sense because you don't have to prove you've read the book, you know, or have bought the book in right. order to rate it, which on Amazon, you have to have bought the book.
Yeah, I hope people give this, you know, before we even decided to start recording these or reading them together, I saw that a couple people were reading Deed of Paxinarian in the Discord, and I think they were all praising it when they were reading it. So...
this concludes our episode. You can find us on the Legendarium's Discord. The invite link is legendarium.com. We're also on Twitter at Green Team Pod and Reddit. Join us in supporting the Legendarium via Patreon. Thanks to Professor Craig for loaning us a little corner of your media empire. Shout out to Horizon Brave for starting it all. Thank you to our panelist,
Hello.
Jingles 90. For joining me in this, and until next time, bye. Music is Galactic Damages by Jingle Punks.
See ya.